You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Well, my goodness, if the listeners could see behind the scenes at the Cycling Podcast this week, what a shambles.
Yeah, the napalm recording studio. Everyone else has been fine.
Oh, my goodness. We've had chickens squawking. We've had people stepping on bits of broken glass and bleeding heels and all kinds of stuff going on. Lionel, Bernie, how are you? Anybody would think you had a bit of a kind of eventful day yesterday, and today's a hangover, is it?
No, not particularly. I'm a little bit hoarse from shouting at Wembley as my football team made it to the FA Cup final, and I missed the Tour of Flanders in its entirety. So
first whistle of the football police after 43 seconds.
Don't turn off, listeners. We will be talking about the Tour of Flanders. Two of us, at least, were paying attention to the Tour of Flanders. Daniel Freep, how are you, Daniel?
Fine. Yeah, no worries.
Sorry, Lionel, I cut in there.
I did watch the I did watch the last 100 kilometres of the Tour of Flanders today.
Good.
So I know what happened.
How's your heel?
It's bleeding, and it had a piece of glass stuck in it. But, don't worry, everyone. I'll just soldier on. If you lose me for a prolonged period of time, do worry.
Okay, well, just set the scene. I'm sitting in a car park out the back of the Flanders Centre in Oudenaarde, very much after the Lord Mayor's show. It certainly feels like that here.
Any sign of Freddie Martins, Rich? Does he still kick around there?
Yeah, he does. I didn't see him today. I also missed Filippo Pozzato, who posed for a picture outside.
Didn't we all? We all missed him. Centre. We all missed him.
Well, he wrote the Sportif on Saturday. One of our podcast listeners spotted him riding the Sportif on Saturday. So that was nice to see. He's still riding his
bike.
Did
he finish?
I don't know that. We'd have to check. I presume that's in your news roundup, Lionel.
No, it's not.
Well, speaking of which, can we have your news roundup?
We can.
Before you pass out.
Yeah. Oh, feeling a bit faint. This episode will be focusing very much on the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix, which is coming up at the weekend. But the other news, there was Dwars door Vlaanderen in midweek, and Dutch champion Matthew van der Poel outsprinted Anthony Tergis of Direct Energy, Bob Jungels, Lucas Postelberger and Thijs Benoot at the finish. Big win for van der Poel. The women's race was won by Ellen van Dijk, who finished half a minute clear of a chase group led home by Marta Bastianelli, who then went on to win the Tour of Flanders Bastianelli, beating Annemiek van Vleuten and Cecily Utrip Ludwig on the line. It's the second World Tour win of the season for the Italian after she won the Ronde van Drenthe in the Netherlands a few weeks ago. The Giro di Sicilia in Sicily was won by Brandon McNulty, 21-year-old American rider with the Rally UHC team. He finished just ahead of Guillaume Martin, the French rider who won the stage on Etna. And Martin's written a novel, by the sounds of it. Is that right?
Yeah.
Daniel, do you know anything about that?
I think it's semi-autobiographical and also weaves in various bits of philosophy. Haven't we all written a book like that?
He's the philosopher king, isn't he? Well, we had him on Kilometre Zero at the Tour de France 2 years ago, where he talked a bit about his interest in philosophy and writing, and he's written a play as well. So he's an interesting young man.
Very, yeah. Just Etna brings me out in hives, because that was where Daniel forced me to engage in Lionel Learns Italian and then presented me with a whole complicated tract about the cultural significance of Etna, whereas I was expecting something about how to order an ice cream. Start with something simple. Anyway, we'll probably pick that up at the Giro in a month's time, won't we, Daniel?
Just on a semi-related note, Lionel, there were reports this week that the road, or one of the roads up to the summit, there's a series of buildings up there where the press room was at the Giro. But the road is going to be extended, I think, and the Giro organisers, RCS, are hoping to have a summit finish. I think it's around about 3,000 metres above sea level at some point in the future, so pretty close to the crater.
Wow. Wow. Mark Sarrow of Groupama FDJ continued his good run of recent results by winning the Route Adelie. He's on a run of 5 podium finishes in a row in smaller French one-day races. And another Frenchman, Jonathan Hivert of Direct Energy, won the Grand Prix Miguel Indurain ahead of a group containing Luis Leon Sanchez, Mikel Nieve and Tadej Pogacar. Some news from the world of cyclocross. Dutch cyclocross rider Denise Betsema tested positive for anabolic steroids at the UCI Cyclocross World Cup in Hoogeheide at the end of January. The UCI has announced that. She won the World Cup in Coxeter in Belgium in quite impressive style and was 4th in the UCI World Championships in Denmark at the end of the cyclocross season, but tested positive for an anabolic steroid. Denies any wrongdoing, but that case will obviously have to be will have to reach a conclusion. And finally, Peter Kenyuk of the Bora Hansgrohe team has taken an indefinite break from racing while he gets to grips with some mental health difficulties. Daniel, do you know a bit more about this?
Not really, Napalm. Just that I saw him a couple of times over the winter, and he seemed to be back on the right track. He had some of the same issues last year, and it seems as though, we're not privy to the exact details of how it's played out, but that Bora Hansgrohe have been pretty well. They've been very sympathetic, and you know, they gave him the time that he thought he needed last year, and you know, they've dealt with it pretty well. So you know, I saw some people suggesting that cycling needs to do more to you know, help riders with mental health issues, and it's obviously an increasing growing problem, I would say, in society in general. But you know, it's a tricky one, isn't it, because it's a sport in which we as fans glory in the difficulty of it, and the physical suffering, and that physical suffering can spill over into mental issues. You know, if you speak to someone like Greg LeMond about the toll of stage racing and the effect that has on someone's endocrine system, their hormones, which then will affect their mental state, and then, you know, the two are kind of difficult bedfellows, really, good mental health and peak performance in professional cycling. So it's a tricky issue, but I mean, generally speaking, I think the attitudes, certainly among teams, and especially when you consider that every team has 2 or 3, 4 doctors that are pretty much on call for the riders, I generally think they do okay based on what I've seen. Of course, everyone, you know, not just cycling teams, but everyone can improve and will need to improve on that score, because, as I say, it's a huge issue that's growing.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of courage, I think, to put that in the public domain as well, and be honest and open about the difficulties that he's having. So hopefully he can get himself back on track and deal with those difficulties.
The fastest clothing in the World Tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019. As they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
I like the bib shirt of Rafa because they're really comfortable. My name is Alberto Bettiol and I race for Team EF Education First. Yesterday I also tested him in the cobbles and they are pretty good. No, I have any issue about it. So I'm looking forward to keep on riding with the chamois of Rafa, and I recommend you, all of you guys, all this bib shirt.
Well, that was none other than the Tour of Flanders winner, Alberto Bettiol. We heard there extolling the virtues of the Rafa bib shorts. And we had an interview with Alberto Bettiol last week, of course, in the podcast. But we must say a big thanks to our headline sponsor Rafa, and tell you this week about the new Core collection, including the Cork Cargo bib shorts. The bib shorts, Rafa's entry-level shorts, have been updated to offer everything you need for every day on the bike, allowing you to carry more whatever the style of riding. They feature the same hugely popular pockets on the legs and back, which were first introduced on the Explorer collection. I've got a pair of these shorts. Have you, Lionel? I think we were sent a pair of these shorts by Rafa.
Yes, I have.
Very
yes,
kindly. Very. Do you use your pocket for gels and things? Maybe a telephone?
I haven't actually ridden my bike very much this year. I'm just about to start my season. I've been running up to this point, so
I like the shorts with the pockets in them because they look like I've got more muscular thighs.
Do you know what's fascinating, chaps? I had lunch on Friday. I was very lucky to have lunch with the Rafa founder, and I think he's chief executive, is he?
Yes, he is.
So, Mr. Simon Mottram, friend of the podcast, backer of the podcast. Anyway, we were talking about indoor cycling of the turbo trainer variety, of the Zwift variety in particular. Mm. And this is apparently having an effect on the way clothing manufacturers are sort of thinking about their ranges and so forth, to the extent that sales of winter clothing might go down in the future because so many people are on there.
That's interesting.
Cycling indoors.
That's interesting, yeah. That's a good point. Speaking of Zwift, have you heard this rumour doing the rounds, Daniel, about the Giro and Zwift?
I have heard the rumour. Go on.
The Giro may have a Zwift prologue in a couple of years. That instead of a prologue out on the open road, it may be a Zwift-style prologue.
A ceremonial prologue to assign the first pink jersey, am I right?
Yeah. Yeah.
This wasn't an April Fool, was it?
No, this is genuine.
It should have been.
Anyway, back to our headline sponsor, Rafa. Thank you very much to Rafa. If you want to see these shorts, the new Core Cargo bib shorts, you'll find them at rafa.cc. Also, read Rafa's interview with Taylor Finney ahead of Paris-Roubaix, which is his big race, and we'll hear a little bit from Taylor Finney later in the episode as well, at rafa.cc, and subscribe to Rafa on YouTube to follow EF Gone Racing throughout the Spring Classics. So, chaps, Tour of Flanders, Alberto Bettiol, a surprise winner. What did you... Well, you studied the last 100 kilometres, Lionel. You watched the race. Daniel, I was here in Oudenaarde watching the race live, and you probably... It's less easy to be really focused on the sort of key action when it happens. So, I had half an eye on that and half an eye on the teams setting up and where I was going to be at the finish and so on. But it looked to me like Bettiol, seized... the moment and went, and I wasn't sure whether he got away because he was the strongest or because a lot of the other favourites maybe looked at each other at that point and let him go where they might not have let somebody like Greg Van Avermaet go, for example.
I think that's probably fair, Rich, but it's back to your point that you make about commitment. Bettiol was absolutely committed from the minute he went on the Alpe de Quadamont and got the gap. And the chase was never fully committed. It was left to Greg Van Avermaet a couple of points to do quite a lot of work. And when he got fed up of towing everybody else along and swung over, no one really took it up. And so it was the old thing of nobody in the chase group wanted to commit to being the one to burn their energy bringing back Bettiol. And Bettiol really just had to put his head down and go for it. But it was a long way, an impressive ride. What was it? 18 kilometres to go mm-hmm. when he went, and then obviously had to then get over the Paterberg, and then that interminable run in for him on real dead roads, really a real feat, a really impressive ride. But I guess that everyone's focused on the fact that Bettiol's never won a pro race before. Quite a big pro race to open your account with. But you think back a couple of weeks to Milan San Remo and his move on the Poggio, where he sort of opened the gap, and then when the next move came over the top, he didn't have the legs to go with it. But clearly, was feeling good at a certain point, and then it just melted away from him on that occasion. But this time, he had the strength to bring it home, and behind... It was all about that hesitation and the sort of the silent negotiations about who was going to take it up, and with not enough workers to do that work, you know, everybody would have been thinking about their own chances of winning the race. And so it just came down to that lack of cooperation, really, at the finish.
Yes, Lionel, I think you're absolutely right. And yeah, this has been sort of my hobby horse for a year or so now, but the issue of the smaller teams, I think we saw it again, the fact that teams can only really afford to take control now of these long one-day races in one phase of the race. And they can't control it for 100 kilometres. And, you know, we saw various teams, CCC at one point, you know, decided it was their moment or when they could use up some bullets. There were other teams that did the same. But then they paid for it because what you were left with in the end was a team of captains. Oh, sorry, a group of captains, effectively. A group of guys who thought they could win the race, wanted to win the race. And, you know, they didn't have two or three domestiques that they could use to chase and sort of damn whatever anyone else wanted to do, what any other team's agenda was. You know, they were just going to chase. That never happened. And you know, they also managed to put De Koninck Quickstep, I think, on the back foot for a lot of the race. I know they had Asgreen down the road, who's one of the stars, the revelations of the race, but they never really got one of their big hitters away. De Koninck Quickstep and forced the others, the Van Avermaets, the Sagans, onto the back foot. It was they, I thought, were chasing the race for a lot of the time.
Do you know what I think the decisive moment in the race was?
Go on.
I think it was Sepp Van Marck crashing at E3 about 10 days ago, because, you know, we saw Van Marck go out pretty early. He's a rider who is always, you know, he's always the team leader in these races. And he went pretty early, almost as if he was, you know, accepting that he wasn't in the sort of condition that he would have liked to have been, or, you know, that he and Bettiol were sort of sharing leadership of the team. He sort of, you know, there was a chance that might work, because we've seen some of these early-ish moves succeed. But if it didn't, then he was setting it up quite nicely for Bettiol, because he's just the sort of rider who might have been waiting, and that might have stopped Bettiol from going when he did.
Well, Rich, as well, I think if you'd turned it around and if that had been De Koninck Quickstep who had ridden the race, the EF road, you would have said classic De Koninck Quickstep. But right from the moment where even Brescia was off the front at one point, and he kind of... he stretched the race a little bit, and then Van Marck, if that had been a Jungels, and then Stieber had been in the Bettiol role, and then of course the other man who was crucial was Langevelt in the group, who managed to interrupt the chase just enough. I felt that if it had got to 14 seconds or 13 seconds, and then they would have started to scent blood. And they would have committed to the chase. But as long as it was above 15 seconds, there was too much dissension in that group, and they never really committed. It was frustrating to watch. I mean, saw some of the comments afterwards, Van Avermaet saying that he didn't want to drag faster guys to the line. I mean, Greg Van Avermaet's a fast rider, and at the end of a race like Tour of Flanders, you know, the hierarchy is a bit mixed up, isn't it? Is he sure that, or was he sure that he wasn't going to beat a Christophe or a Sagan or a Valverde in a group sprint like that? I mean, I think he would have been better off sort of gambling and risking defeat in a sprint rather than sort of hanging out to dry in the way that they did.
Van Avermaet had some interesting comments about Betty afterwards. They were teammates at BMC last year, and he went on Belgian television immediately after the race and obviously expressed his surprise at the winner, saying that he thought Bettiol was a little bit lazy at BMC, which seems pretty harsh. He had a nasty crash at BMC, which certainly interrupted his season. But he also said that he had been surprised last year when Bettiol was selected for the Tour of Flanders, having not finished E3 or Dwars Door Vlaanderen. And he alleged that his DS at the time, Fabio Baldato, told him that he'd been picked because his family had booked plane tickets to Flanders. I'm not sure if that's true or not. Pretty outrageous stuff there from Greg Van Avermaet, unusually for him. But he was obviously surprised that Bettiol was winner, as most people were. But we have, as you mentioned, Lionel, seen flashes this year of his talent. I mean, Milan-San Remo, his attack on the Poggio really set things up there. And then at E3, he rode extremely well as well. I did get some reaction from EF Education First after the race. They were obviously cock-a-hoop with the result and also the manner of it, because as you say, Daniel, it was a great team performance. They had people in all the right places, and Langeveld was a key man in the closing stages. He was there and he was a danger, and he was one of these guys who was perhaps preventing those riders from committing fully to the chase. So I spoke to Andreas Clear, the sports director at EF Education First, who finished second at the Tour Flanders, didn't he, in 2005 behind Tom Bonin. So he knows this race extremely well, used to live in the area. And spoke to Andreas Clear. We'll hear from him first, and then we'll hear from Sebastian Langeveld, his teammate at EF Education First.
This is a race very dear to your heart. So what does that
tell me?
What can you sum up what you feel?
I mean, obviously the last 12K were very intense, right? And so I said you just drop everybody on the Quaremont, because obviously somehow you're the strongest on picture. And you go from there, and then I tried in whatever how many languages to push him towards the finish line.
I spoke to you a few weeks ago.
I smell also a little bit now, I have to say. Sorry for that. But you can't smell it anyway. Right?
I spoke to you a few weeks ago about this race, and you said how important it was to get, we were talking about Seth Van Marck particularly, to get him out front at the head of the race early on, and he did that. Was that really crucial today?
Yes. We had a very... it's not because I made it, but I think we had a very good team tactic. We wanted to be defensive until to the Mur, be aware what's going to happen on the Mur, be there and go from there offensive. So that means whenever somebody moves, we move with them. And somehow it worked out.
And was Bettiol your leader going into the race, or was he just one of three guys who had a chance?
No, we had two leaders. We had Sebastian and we had Alberto.
And are you surprised that he was able to get away as he did and hold off that group?
I was not surprised that he drops him. That he holds it, that's another story, right? But he did pretty well, I would say.
How do you reflect on what happened out there?
Yeah, it's an amazing day for the team, for Alberto Bettiol, for myself, for everybody involved. I think it's a well-deserved victory, and for me, it's one of the most beautiful races in the year, Tour of Flanders, and we as a team pulled it off today.
Well, I mean, you had Seth Van Marck up the road. You performed really as a team, but when Bettiol went clear, did you think he had a chance of staying away on his own?
Well, he was definitely. He didn't rode away on a sneaky way. He rode away. He rode basically all the favorites off the wheel on the Quaremont. So, he was probably the strongest guy in the race, but I think we still went pretty fast in the end, and he kept those 20, 25 seconds. I could play a little bit, keep the speed out of it every now and then. Yeah, great teamwork, and we won Flanders. That's incredible.
And what can you tell us about Alberto Bettiol? I mean, you spent a couple of weeks with him here in Belgium. I don't think many people had him down as a potential winner.
Well,
but
yeah, he's, like you said, he's probably was amongst the favorites, but he was fourth in E3, and he went with Van Avermaet on the Tegenberg, and he could follow, so that's 1 week ago, and he attacked on the Poggio as well. So I think it's one of the guys, you know, with a huge potential, and probably his career is launched now today.
So we heard there from Andreas Clear and then Sebastian Langeveld. Interestingly, I spoke to Clear a few weeks ago about the Tour of Flanders and their plan, and he said that the thing that he was hoping to persuade Sepp van Marck, their leader in Flanders, was to attack early, was to go early, because in the last couple of years we have seen winning moves go earlier and earlier. I mean, Philippe Gilbert a couple of years ago was obviously extremely early, but it's been important, I think, to be on the front foot and to have others chasing you rather than having to chase. And that's what Van Marck did so brilliantly, perhaps because he wasn't as fit as he would have liked to have been following his crash.
I think just picking up on something both of you said, Daniel, your point about, the similarity between De Koninck, Quickstep and EF's tactics. I mean, they effectively rode the very similar races, because with around 85k to go, there was that move with Yves Lampert of De Kooning in it, with Matty Breschel of EF. Lucas Postelberger was in there for Peter Sagan and Bora Hansgrohe, and the other rider in there was Nelson Oliveira of Movistar for Alejandro Valverde. And that was a classic kind of starter, or the hors d'oeuvre in the Tour of Flanders that we see so often, when you see a group of riders who perhaps aren't the most protected in their team but are dangerous enough to cause a bit of chaos, a bit of havoc, and get people panicking. And that then set up the kind of the next move, which also the Van Mark move, which then had Stijn Vandenberg in it as well for AG2R, and Askren was in there. That was in going into the sort of final phase of the race, the last 55 kilometers or so. So EF really plotted their way round very well, and you know, they probably do deserve the plaudits for that we would be lavishing on De Kooning, Quickstep, for, you know, all their knowledge and know-how and working out how to win these kind of races. They seized every moment in those last 100 kilometers, textbook kind of stuff really. And then Betiol did benefit from being perhaps not the most marked man in that move, but that so often happens, doesn't it? It could so easily have been, you know, one of the other riders in. You know, would anyone have chased Niels Pollitt or, you know, Jens Kukkelaer or?
Well, I mean, I think even more so Betiol, Lionel. If you look at his record in the Tour of Flanders, I mean, he has slowly come to prominence over the last couple of years, but in Flanders, he's had a couple of DNFs and I think a 27th place, and that's it.
But Rich, I was quite surprised seeing Lampert in that move so far out. But I gather that was because Bob Jungels was the number one protected man for De Kooning Quickstep.
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, Jungels has been in great form, and I think his form and his energy deserted him at Flanders, unfortunately for him. But he apparently was the guy that they really fancied for the race, and Patrick Lefebvre was very confident that he could win it. And, you know, it's funny, isn't it? Because they still finished second, De Kooning Quickstep. I went and interviewed Wilfred Peters, their sports director at the finish, and I was sort of commiserating with him, or you know, looking for some kind of reflection on a Flanders failure, completely forgetting that their young Dane, Kasper Asgreen, had finished second in the race after a pretty phenomenal ride. So there was a sort of strange mood around the De Kooning Quickstep bus. Orla Shinoui was there because we were recording an episode of the cycling podcast Femina, which will be coming out this week as well. And she spoke to Bob Jungels after the race.
Was Betiol perhaps underestimated slightly when he made his decisive move?
I think by the time he made the move, nobody underestimated him anymore. Everybody was on the limit, otherwise he could have followed. So I believe he was probably the strongest today. And like I just said, it's after such a hard race, which was actually launched quite early, mid-race. And to make a move like that in the final, it's really tough. And I think he deserves that victory.
It looked like there wasn't an awful lot of cohesion in the chase group behind. Is that unfair, do you think?
It's always the same a little bit when the leaders of each team are together. And so I just said the last time after Quarmont, we were five or six guys of different teams. And there's always two or three who won't work. And it's very hard to close the gap, and especially if you have a rider that's going like he did, it's almost impossible. And we basically neutralized ourselves and came up short.
You've had a phenomenal spring. Do you think it was 50 kilometers too many at the end?
Probably was, yeah. Started very early in the season, in a good shape in Colombia. But yeah, it was, every day, every stage was, I was trying to go for the victory, trying to go for GC in Pyrenees. It's been very, using period. So I'm very happy with what I achieved so far, and Of course, today was it was a gamble. Like I say, we came up short, and that's sports.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Voice of Seb Piquet, of course, interrupting this week's episode to remind me to tell you that it is sponsored by The Week magazine. Now, The Week is like a news filter. It pulls together the best and most interesting articles and opinion from over 200 different sources every week. It includes the likes of The Times, The Telegraph, The Guardian, The FT, and every other newspaper or magazine you can think of. It brings you multiple points of view on the most important topics, so you can be sure you've got the full picture. It's your very own anti-echo chamber, if you like. Best of all, you can actually read less and know more. It's a concise summary of the last week, and you have everything you need to know in one quick read. And you can try it for free. I'll let you know how you can do that at the end of this message. But before we hear that, Lionel, you've been flicking through your copy of The Week, as have I. It's like a rich meal, a rich, dense meal, but very enjoyable. As I know you enjoy your rich, dense meals, Lionel. But what's caught your eye?
Well, Rich, the first thing that's caught my eye has been the very striking cover illustrations. A couple of weeks ago, John Bercow, the Speaker of the House of Commons, is pictured holding his hand up and saying no, while Theresa May, the Prime Minister, is at the dispatch box behind him, tied up in legal tape. And last week, Theresa May herself was pictured as the character from Edvard Munch's painting The Scream, with the headline, "The Nightmare Continues." And from that, you might assume that the magazine is, like the rest of our media, dominated by this one big story that seemed to have sucked everything else into its vortex, Brexit. But actually, reading the magazine has shown me kind of what I've been missing out on as a result of having backed myself into a bit of a news and current affairs cul-de-sac. Not intentionally, but I think we all gravitate towards news sources that we like and gravitate towards stories that resonate with us. And the risk of that, particularly online, is that you end up just reinforcing what you already know or what you already think. And so reading The Week and seeing stories from the political left and the political right and somewhere in the middle, as well as international stories alongside British stories, sometimes on the same page, sometimes right next to each other, it's shown that the news agenda doesn't need to be set from one particular point of view, and that actually consuming a broader range of coverage is probably healthier for all of us. And there have been things that I've bristled at a little bit over the last couple of weeks and thought, well, I don't, that sort of challenges me in a way, but it's because I've kind of backed away from being exposed to that kind of media in some senses. So it's been really interesting, and it's also reminded me something that I've thought for a few months now, is that I actually like reading things that are printed on paper. We spend so much time squinting at our screens, don't we? But I've taken The Week on the train, and in a sort of 25-minute train journey, I've found that I've brought myself up to date or informed myself on quite a wide range of subjects. So it's been a really efficient way to get a broad look at what's been going on in the world.
Well, you can join thousands of people who trust The Week as their essential curated news source. You can try it for yourself with your first 6 issues completely free. To get 6 free issues of The Week, visit theweek.co.uk/offer with the offer code cycling. That's theweek.co.uk/offer with the offer code cycling for 6 free issues. So we heard from not so much disappointed, but resigned Bob Jungels before the break there. And he will take a rest now before the Giro. It's unlikely that he'll defend his Liège-Bastogne-Liège title, which is a bit of a shame, perhaps. But
well, he said that back in January, didn't he? That he would go as far as the Tour of Flanders, and then it's all for the Giro.
And I think he'll look at his cobbled classics campaign, his first, as a success. I mean, I think there's a lot to build on, a lot to learn from, and that he'll probably come back to the Tour of Flanders as a real favourite to win it. We shall see. But what about Bettiol, the winner? What can you tell us? I mean, you spoke about him a bit last week, Daniel, and his tendency not to finish races, and Jonathan Vaughter's view in the early years of having him on the team, because he was a rider that they inherited from the old Cannondale team, which previously had been the Liquigas team, an Italian team. And the early signs were not perhaps all that encouraging, were they?
No, I mean, as to his, well, the high number of DNFs that he had in his first few years, I mean, he's actually continued to do that. And it was interesting to note those comments from Van Avermaet, just, you know, sort of doubts about how committed he was last year. But I think he simply is one of those riders who, when he's not having a good day, has no real qualms about pulling to the side of the road and you know, and abandoning races. Some riders do, some riders don't. Some riders make it a point of principle to finish every race they do, whereas others, a bit like actually Bettiol's, well, one of Bettiol's heroes was Paolo Bettini, and he was a guy who, if it wasn't his day, wouldn't even bother trying. I mean, he would know, and he would just sort of accept his fate. But Bettiol, like Bettini, is from Tuscany, a real sort of, a kind of old school sort of story, in the sense that his dad worked in a factory. I think a couple of years ago, his mum was unemployed, but not from a wealthy family. His celebration yesterday, Rich, I don't know if you noticed, but he made this gesture where he pointed to his eyes, and then he explained, I think in the press conference, that this was to do with not getting enough recognition, and that he hoped finally and the Italian press would pay more attention to him. I think the origins of that story might lie in, well, the gentleman that introduced Bettiol to cycling was an older guy who lived in the same building. I think he lived underneath Bettiol's family's flat when he was growing up. And Bettiol used to play football, and this old gentleman was something to do with one of the local cycling teams. And he asked his dad one day, did Alberto want to try cycling? Of course, he was a great success and went on to become a professional. But anyway, apparently this gentleman, who's called Lorenzo Zanobini, he still has this slight sort of obsessive frustration with Italian commentators on the Italian TV coverage not recognizing Bettiol. And apparently he will throw sort of ornaments and kick the furniture and kick the TV, and it's a persistent bugbear of his. And I just wonder whether that has infected Bettiol slightly. The gesture, which some people thought was a little bit petty yesterday, and was the fruit of that.
Others have said it's not surprising that he perhaps hasn't had the recognition that he feels he's due, because he's not really done a lot, to be frank.
Well, I think things started to turn for him in in his second year as a pro. So he had a very difficult first year, and by his own admission, I think he was too young when he turned professional. And then there was this transition whereby the Cannondale team, the old Italian Cannondale team, was absorbed by Jonathan Vaughter's team. And Bettiol didn't speak any English. All of a sudden, he was having to reply to emails and phone calls in English, and he felt very uncomfortable. It took him a few months to sort of find his feet in that setup. But then in the second half of his second pro season, I remember hearing from various members of staff of that team that he had turned a corner, and all of a sudden, from being someone who looked as though he might not have a long career, was proving to be a really, really good domestique. And then the next season and the season after that, that then changed to, no, this is a guy with real potential. And he was starting to get results. Not the quickest rider, but very, very versatile, good on the climbs, a good time trialist. He's also very good in long races. I mean, that was one sort of facet of those early good results that he had. They were often in races like Plouay, which is well over 200 kilometres, in the Canadian one-day races. He had shown a lot of potential, and he's still only 25 now. So it's going to be interesting to see how his career develops. I don't think he's going to be a prolific winner. I mean, he reminds me a little bit, with all the caveats that we might apply to this, and given that his career didn't really work out the way he or his fans would have wanted it. But it reminded me a bit of Alessandro Ballan's Tour of Flanders win. Another Italian who wasn't talked about too much when he was an amateur, turned pro, and was a bit of a dark horse for a lot of his career, and then won the Tour of Flanders and won a world championship.
Yeah, I mean, Bettiol, when we've seen him this year on Milan San Remo and here, his attacks have been spectacular, really, he's been really committed to them, and he's appeared to have a lot of self-belief in order just to make those attacks. You know, you don't attack on the Poggio like that if you don't have some belief in yourself. And I mentioned the fifth place in quite a tough finish at the Tour de France a couple of years ago behind Sagan and Van Avermaet, and he does seem to be a rider who can contest those kinds of finishes that those riders contest. So, but also perhaps a bit more versatile. I mean, he was talking last week about the Ardennes Classics and, you know, liking perhaps a Liège-Bastogne-Liège as well. So,
I think he's definitely going to be a one-day specialist, isn't he? He didn't actually, This was one thing he has mentioned as well about those first couple of early difficult seasons that he had. He didn't ride a single stage race before he turned professional. So he never raced 2 or 3 days in a row before, and that was one of the reasons why he found it so hard, I think.
The language thing is interesting because he speaks very, very good English now.
He does, yeah, yeah. And another, just one final little detail on him, Rich. In high school, he wrote his sort of final essay on the life of Gino Bartali, another illustrious Tuscan cyclist. And the sort of spiritual father of Italian cycling, still referred to as the spiritual father of Italian cycling, Alfredo Martini, who was the Italian national coach for decades and died a couple of years ago. He lent Bettiol a book on Bartali that he hoped would help Bettiol in this essay that he was writing. Martini died before Bettiol could return it. And he said that's a great regret that he has, that he never returned the book.
What about other talking points from the Tour of Flanders then? Nicky Terp's just crash with 160 kilometres to go was a bad one. Wish him a speedy recovery, but I think he's going to be out of Paris-Roubaix certainly this weekend coming. Terpstra, of course, the defending champion, and crashed in the week, I think, as well, didn't he? So a rough time for a Terpstra of Direct Energy. Another Dutchman, Matthew van der Poel, I would say was man of the match, really. Very flamboyant performance, very, very visible in his Dutch national champions kit. Of course, he's had a string of really good results lately. It's a bit of a pattern. First at the Grand Prix de Nantes, fourth at Gent-Wevelgem, first at Dwars door Vlaanderen, and fourth at the Tour of Flanders. But he was in a really spectacular crash with around 60 kilometres to go, where he was on the right-hand side of the road, and there was a curb, a traffic calming measure with looked like it had some kind of plant in the middle of it. That suddenly jutted out into the road, and he tried to bunny hop it using his cyclocross skills. I think he flatted his front tyre because where he was really trying to keep the bike upright, and then wobbled onto the pavement and went down. And I thought that was it, game over for van der Poel at that point. But he chased back on. He got back on going up the Alde Quaremont, looked really good. And then I did think he did perhaps a bit too much in the last phase of the race. He was chasing things down. He was on the front a bit. He went away, or he tried to sort of make a bit of a move in the last 15K, which Valverde shut down quite quickly. But then fourth in the sprint, just behind Alexander Kristoff. I thought that was ride of the day. And finally, Dylan van Baarle, who's got a very good record at the Tour of Flanders. He's been fourth and sixth before. Probably Sky's outstanding rider on the day. It got into that move, but probably it was the one before the one he needed to be in.
Tour of Flanders 10, Team Sky nil.
Well, of course.
Just
yeah.
to update our friend special that we released last week, Tour of Flanders 9, Team Sky nil. That was a look at why Team Sky have never cracked the Tour of Flanders, a run that has continued. One final little talking point for me from Tour of Flanders. I think looking at Lotto Soudal, they had numbers. They had Tim Wellens was there in the thick of things till quite late. Tish Benoot, I think, was ninth in the end. And Jens Kuchelaer looked very strong as well. And I think for all that horsepower, they didn't come away with an awful lot. And, you know, they were there and they were clearly strong, but they didn't, again, a bit like Van Baarle, maybe just didn't get into the right moves.
But also wouldn't want to just set it up for somebody else. I mean, that is a factor in the final part of the race. Everyone looks at the teams with numbers. And when the teams with numbers are, you know, De Koenig, Quickstep and Lotto Soudal, I don't think they really want to lay it on a plate for their rivals in particular. So I wouldn't be too harsh on them there, especially as, Benoit probably wasn't going to win the sprint, was he? And Kukulé had done quite a lot of work earlier on. I thought it was a sort of a, you know, C minus rather than a
all
real
right,
bad day.
All right.
C minus is pretty bad. C minus is
yeah, true. Yeah, true.
I never got a C minus. Did you?
No, probably not. But you know, there's D and E that come after that, Daniel, and then fail completely. You know, ungraded. So.
Wow.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. We are very grateful to them. And they are offering 25% off to you, the listener, at scienceinsport.com. Just use the code SISCP25, that's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com, and you'll get 25% off all your sports nutrition products. Keep your questions coming in for the Science and Sport experts, please, as well. Contact at thecyclingpodcast.com or leave us a WhatsApp voice memo on our WhatsApp number, which you'll find on our Twitter profile. I'm sitting in my car in a car park outside the back of the Flanders Centre. I can't look it up at the moment, I'm afraid, because I'm using my phone, and that's just beyond me. Lionel, how's your heel?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, Rich. I mean, I'm just going to ask, can I put a new office rug on Cycling Podcast expenses, please? Because I've dripped blood all over it.
Oh, I don't see really what that has got to do with... I don't see that was the Cycling Podcast fault. We didn't cause you to cut your heel.
No, fair enough. I'll just have to take
However,
this one.
If we do need to raise the funds to buy Lionel a new carpet, please do sign up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Thanks everyone who has. You heard our friend special last week. That was Tour of Flanders 9, Team Sky 0. The next friend special must be imminent, surely.
Yeah,
we've been trailing it for longer than, I don't know, something that's been trailed for a long time.
Wow.
With Patrick Lefebvre.
With Paris-Roubaix coming up, seems like the perfect time.
It was always planned like this. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to that. Patrick Lefebvre.
Just before we press on with looking ahead at Paris-Roubaix, I was going to just make the point that watching the race, watching the last 100 kilometres, knowing the result, it's a completely different experience, and you pick up so much more knowing what is and isn't going to work, and you're not kind of, it's not as enjoyable as watching a bike race unfold, but I found like I was watching it on a slightly different level. It was it was quite an interesting experience.
I watched the Olympic road race in Rio like that, knowing the result, and it was fascinating just to watch Greg Van Avermaet from 100 kilometers out or whatever it was, and just how he rode the race, when he made efforts, when he didn't make efforts, which moves he followed, which he didn't. Really, really interesting to do that. It's a bit like reading a novel for a second time. It's not as much fun, but you do get an awful lot more out of it. Interesting to do it like that. I'm sure the DSs all look back, all watch the races again, and that's where they actually learn about really what happened and what worked and what didn't work. It'd be interesting. There's an idea for a friend special. We've done this with Matt Heyman, obviously watched Paris-Roubaix with him, but to spend a day watching Tour of Flanders or something with a DS and talking through what happened, what they could learn, what they could do differently next time. That'd be an interesting exercise, I think, for a friend special.
Keep your ideas under your hat, Rich.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we can get that one out before the Patrick Lefebvre one at this rate. Anyway, Paris-Roubaix. Daniel, you must have... 18. I haven't even done my...
I can think of a few riders to watch.
Have you? How did your 18 tips for Flanders get on? Have you
well,
done
as I told someone on Flanders, is the second it's broadcasted, that list gets destroyed and erased from memory. So I don't know.
And you read it out too quickly for me to write it down. Yeah, every week I try to write it down, so I'm poised now.
Was it Het Nieuwsblad that copied your idea?
Oh, Rich, there have been so many people this week. 18 is the new number du jour. Everyone is producing 18, this, 18, that.
So
this week there's a... This week there's a golf tournament in
don't tell me it's over 18 holes.
Called the US Masters over 18
holes. Oh my God, that's incredible. The power of the cycling podcast. Incredible. What about 18 names for Pyro Bay then?
Okay, in descending order?
It doesn't matter. Random
most
order.
To win.
Random order.
Most likely to win, of course. Peter Sagan, Van Avermaet, Stibart, Degenkolb, Narsen, Pollitt, Van Aert, Seneschal, Stuyven, Lampaert, Rowe, Van Mark, Langevelt, Trentin, Demar, Dillier, Van Baarle, Hausler.
Hausler.
Yeah.
I was waiting for you to sneak Van der Poel in, but of course you know he's not riding.
No
Corrington Circus in Paris-Roubaix.
Sagan's made your list.
That was partly facetious, obviously. Yeah. That's partly facetious because I'm still not convinced.
Still not convinced he can win it. No. Famously, he can't ride it on the cobbles. He's not aerodynamic enough.
Another rider, on a semi-serious point, another thing I say every year, Rich, there's this big misnomer about Alexander Kristoff always being, you know, one of the hot tips for Paris-Roubaix, despite not having a very good record in Paris-Roubaix and never looking particularly good on the cobbles. So I don't think, although Kristoff has had a very good spring, I would suggest, but I am not expecting him to contend.
Why is that? Sorry. Kristoff, sorry, because he does have everything, and you would think with his weight as well and his sort of heft and bulk, Paris-Roubaix would be perfect for him, but I mean,
I don't really want to get into this again, Lionel, because we've done this before. But it's got a lot to do with position on the bike and pedaling style, hasn't it? And I suggest you could probably, and I'm sure physiologists and experts have been able to break it down and establish, you know, there's a certain type of pedaling stroke, a certain type of mechanical efficiency, which is more suited to Paris-Roubaix. Actually, on this subject, there was a very good blog posted by Katusha Alpecin this week, and it was an interview with their coach Kevin Poulton about the difference in the types of effort required in the Tour of Flanders as against Paris-Roubaix. How in the Tour of Flanders, it's basically all 3 to 5 minute efforts, and Paris-Roubaix is actually quite different.
It is. It's more sustained, isn't it, Paris-Roubaix?
Yes.
I think of Degenkolb, you know, he won the Paris-Roubaix stage of the Tour de France last year. He looked pretty good at Flanders for a rider who's maybe not best suited to that race. And I think he might be coming into some form. But Niels Pollitt is an interesting little choice on your list because he has been looking pretty good. And Katusha Alpecin have had a pretty dire season, haven't they? And I must send good wishes to friend of the podcast, Ian Boswell, who had a terrible crash at Tirreno Adriatico and has returned home to the US to recover. And I know it's going to be quite a long process for Ian to get back to full health. So we wish him all the best. He kept a diary for us at the Tour de France, of course, last year, but hope to see him back racing again soon. But it's been a pretty poor season so far for Katusha Alpecin, but Niels Pollitt rode extremely well in Flanders.
Well, for that reason, I found Pollitt's ride yesterday all the more impressive because they're under a lot of pressure, and obviously, and they almost rode as though they're under a lot of pressure. They were really trying very hard to do something in the race and leave their mark on the race somehow. And Pollitt's obviously going well, and he's improved every year.
Rich, you mentioned that Roubaix stage of last year's Tour, stage 9, almost 100 kilometres shorter than Paris-Roubaix, of course, but the top six there, Degenkolb, Van Avermaet, Lampaert, Gilbert, Sagan, Stuyven, you wouldn't be surprised if that was, the finished group or people up at the pointy end. Kristoff was 11th on that stage in the third group. Niels Pollitt was just behind him. So, you know, not too shabby there, Kristoff. But then Warren Barguil was also in that group. So what does that tell us?
Lampaert, it does fancy Paris-Roubaix, doesn't he? That's his favourite race. And I've been expecting a big result from him this spring. I did say ages ago that he'd win the Tour of Flanders. Well, he didn't do that. So maybe Paris-Roubaix. I'm mentioning as many names as I can just so that we can play a clip next week of me predicting the winner.
What about my 17th consecutive year of tipping France, Florian Seneschal.
I didn't hear. Was he in your list?
Yeah, oh yeah, he's definitely in there, Rich. It's been broadcast, so it's been destroyed, the list, but I think he was in about 8th.
Think this is his year?
Well, he was overlooked for... he's obviously not going that well because he missed out on selection for the Tour of Flanders, which I think it was probably a bit of a surprise and not a very nice surprise for him. But he's been going okay. So he'll be in the mix, I expect.
Should we just hear a little bit from Yves Lampaert? And just maybe the whole of his spring has been pointing towards this Sunday.
If you had to choose one race that you could win, which one?
Then I prefer Paris-Roubaix.
Ah, even though you're a son of Flanders and you know those roads so well.
Yeah, but I also don't live that far from Roubaix. So, but for me, Roubaix is a bit more mythical than Tour of Flanders. And I hope one day I can win.
But if you're in the final group in the Tour of Flanders, you're not going to say, "Oh, I'll save for Paris-Roubaix."
No. I hope that I can win Tour of Flanders also one time.
Yves Lampaert there, the Belgian champion, who perhaps surprisingly prefers Paris-Roubaix or fancies his chances more at Paris-Roubaix. And that, you were speaking to him, Lionel, back in Calpe in southern Spain in January, weren't you, when you were at the training camp?
Which was
released as an episode earlier in the year, wasn't it? Or the Koenig Quick-Step special.
It was.
Somebody else who will fancy his chances perhaps at Paris-Roubaix, though he has been struggling a little bit with injury. Somebody who wasn't on your list, I don't believe, Daniel, from memory, Taylor Finney.
You're going to say, oh, no, not on my list.
Well, Taylor Finney, Tom Wally of the Cycling Podcast did speak to Taylor Finney recently, and about this race in particular, about the sort of his new approach to training. Here is the inimitable Taylor Finney.
I feel a lot less anxiety and stress around what I'm quote unquote supposed to be doing every day, and I approach it more in an organic, artistic, creative kind of a way, where my intention is to allow the training to kind of form itself by going out and just thinking what I want to improve on and what is coming up in my schedule and what are my goals. For me, it's as simple as that. Like, if you take the sort of classic training structure, like you're just given these amount of blocks and these amount of intervals that you have to do every day. But I've never been told by a coach, like, okay, we're going to go out today and I want you to think and dream about Paris-Roubaix. And these efforts are for Paris-Roubaix. It's all just about, like, okay, we're going to create, we're trying to build your motor, we're trying to build structure. But I respond so much more strongly to dreaming and imagining, like, what I'm trying to be good at and what I want to do with my body. And also having the space to listen to my body so that if I am inside of an interval, I don't feel trapped in that interval, and I feel like I can, like, there's just some space, like there's some slack in the rope for me to move. If I think of myself 5 years ago, I would be like, okay, I'm riding at 420 and I'm holding that, and if it starts to dip, like, I freak out, my legs hurt, and it shouldn't feel like this. And now I'm just like, I just let myself breathe for like 5 seconds and I bring it back, and then I can ramp it back up. The way that I train now is much more sustainable for me as an athlete and as a human. And I like to share about it, so I'm glad that you asked.
So you talked a bit about then about using, say, winning Paris-Roubaix as a motivation. Do you visualize that? And if you do, what does it look like? Do you visualize a particular way that you win the race?
So that is more of like imagining the stress of and the build, the progression into the pavé section, which is more of a part of classics racing than the actual section itself. That was something I always wanted, that I always brought up with previous coaches, was like, why don't I train like a progression into a section or into the bottom of a climb, because that's what a race is like. So it's kind of getting into that space and focusing less on the pure numbers, but working under that kind of mental fatigue and also physical fatigue. One of the most important things I've learned as an athlete is just to look up. I find that affects me. My thoughts go in a much more negative direction when I'm looking down than when I'm looking up. And it sounds super simple, but and maybe trivial, but there's a reason that people say, like, keep your head up, look up. It's a cliche for a reason.
So when we see you at Paris-Roubaix this year, you know, we'll see you taking it in as you're racing.
Yeah, well, I tried to do that as much as I could last year. Just being in the front of that race, of a race that I've watched so many times and have thought about so many times, and all of a sudden I was there, I was caught between this like intense doubt, this intense fear of this voice saying, like, you're gonna get dropped, don't get dropped, but, you know, you're gonna get dropped because you're totally done, you know. You get the wild thing about these races is that once the final selection is made, like, everybody in that selection is toasted, and it's the person who has just that little bit extra, which is so impossible to quantify or define or observe. But when I was there, I was like, damn, like, this is the coolest thing, you know? I'm in it, like, I'm in it right now, and I have all of my friends in Boulder are at the local Rafa store, and they're watching, and they're freaking out, and my parents are freaking out, and my girlfriend is freaking out, and, like, the future version of myself that's watching this race is also freaking out, because it's, like, it's happening, you're right there. So just drink it in and stop doubting, stop worrying about getting dropped, and just, like, just ride until you die, man.
So that was Taylor Finney of EF Education First. Didn't finish Tour of Flanders. As I say, he's been struggling a little bit with injury. But he rode well at Paris-Roubaix last year. And these have always been the races that he's been fancied to do well in. So coming off the back of a Tour of Flanders win with Bettiol, you know, who knows what. That team is on a roll, isn't it? I mean, they've struggled for wins the last couple of years in their various incarnations, and it's a team that almost went out of existence about 18 months ago. They've really come out the blocks looking very good this year, and they've notched up a few wins already.
It was really interesting, Rich. I mentioned my lunch with Simon Mottram of Rafa last week, and just talking to him about the sponsorship model of EF and what they're hoping to achieve. And I don't think this is the only thing they're hoping to achieve with the team and their sponsorship, but it's certainly a big rallying point for their staff. It's almost something that they have, well, as I said, one of the big reasons why they've invested in cycling is to give the employees of language schools, aren't they, EF? But they have a huge number of people employed around the world, and to give them something to get excited about and feel a part of and identify with. And they're not the first sponsor to have that sort of vision. I know that T-Mobile thought that was a big part of the value that cycling brought to them, and Mappe were the same in Italy.
Yeah, there were a lot of people in EF Education First kit at the finish yesterday, clearly associated with the company rather than the team. So interesting, and yeah, they're on a bit of a roll. Who knows where that could end up. Shall we wrap things up there, chaps? Got Paris-Roubaix to look forward to, also the Tour of the Basque Country this week, which is one of my favourite races of the year, and we haven't talked about it at all, but we will talk about that next week. It's another outing for the stage race specialists. How's your heel before we go, Lionel? Just a quick update on that, please.
Oh, it's fine, Rich. It's fine.
What's your colour? I mean, you're not
pasty.
You're, I was you're quite pasty anyway, so I'm not sure if we'll get much of a sense of your condition from your complexion. But how's it looking?
It's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. I've tracked down some tweezers so I can pull out the sliver of glass, and should be all right. Should be all right for the weekend.
Excellent. Well, yeah.
Thanks for your concern. So genuine.
That's great. And congratulations again on a wonderful football result.
Oh yeah, I need to take a couple of days off from the Giro, which will mean Daniel having to fly solo for a weekend. Sorry about that, Daniel.
I watched the result from that. I did updates to just see what the score was on that game with a vested interest, I must say, thinking about our Giro coverage.
You sent me a text afterwards saying, what an awful result.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, Lionel, I'm delighted. On a personal level, I'm delighted for you, Lionel, but on a professional level, I'm obviously devastated.
Have we got any budget? Can I call in a sub?
Yes.
Yeah, who are you thinking? I mean, Ciro Scon Emilio. I must just mention Ciro missing from Flanders for the first time in years because he was at the new Tour of Sicily instead. And we had a double Italian win with Bastianelli and Bettiol. A coincidence?
I was thinking more Taylor Swift or someone like that.
Taylor Swift on the cycling podcast? What?
Yes. I doubt she'll do it, to be honest.
I doubt she'll do it with our budget. But
I was going to say, anyway. I was going to say, what does she know about cycling? But I don't think that really matters. does it, really? That's optional. Oh. Anyway, met a lot of lovely friends of the cycling podcast at the finish yesterday. Thanks very much to those of you who came and said hello. Always nice to meet people who listen to the podcast. But that's all from us for this week. A reminder that you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com, and you'll find Lionel's Patrick Lefebvre episode there very soon indeed. But that's all from me. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Rich.
Thanks to everyone who signed up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com, and a big thanks to some recently signed up friends: Chiara Ferrara, Issy Ronald, Peter Giddings, Stephen Lockwood, Simon Brooks, Christopher Cundy, and David Johnson.
A big thank you to Marcus Buckle, Russell Cundy, Michael Coleman, Piers Constable, S. Hodkinson, and Mark Howell.
And thanks to Brendan Ritchie, Edward Taylor, Richard Fleming, and Martin Green.
Just a reminder that if you can't watch Paris-Roubaix live at the weekend but want to keep up with what's happening, John McCleary of The Telegraph will be doing his excellent live blog at thetelegraph.co.uk. Well worth a read, lots of nuggets of information in there, not just a sort of blow-by-blow account of what's going on, but it will keep you fully in the picture when you're not in reach of the live pictures.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.